Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 10 of the Chris Chambers Noir Show, where this award-winning best-selling noir author shines a light on some of the top writers in this powerful genre. This month, we have the honor of featuring a Tony Award and Derringer Award-winning writer, Curtis Oppolito. I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, proud producer of the show on Incandescent Radio, Incandescent TV, and you can also listen to us on Spotify, iHeart, and Apple. And of course, you can check out all of our episodes on chrischambersnoir.com. Before I turn the Q&A over to Chris, let me tell you about this month's guest. Burying the Newspaper Man was Curtis's debut novel, published in 2021. His second novel, Waves of Burden, publishes on June 24th, 2026, just a few days from the recording that we're making today. His short fiction has been featured with numerous notable publications, including Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine, Dark Yonder, Tough Genre, as well as being featured in several anthologies, including The 1%. Chris is the guest editor of On Fire and Underwater, a climate change crime fiction anthology from Rock and Hard Place Press. And he is a member of Sisters in Crime Mystery Writers of America and serves as VP for the San Diego chapter of Sisters in Crime. His short fiction has been featured with numerous notable publications, including Ellery Queen Mystery Magazines and Dark Yonder. Curtis is the guest editor of On Fire and Underwater, a climate change crime fiction anthology from Rock and a Hard Place Press. He is a member of the Sisters in Crime Mystery Writers of America and serves as the vice president for the San Diego chapter. Amazing. I can't wait to hear about ordinary people's moral struggle in noir and hard boiled. Over to you, Chris.
Thank you so much. And again, this is Chris Chambers Noir. You can hear us on Spotify, iHeartRadio, Incandescent Radio Network, and Apple Podcasts. And you can watch our pretty faces on YouTube, which is always a bonus, you know, when you see your favorite author actually expounding and smiling or frowning, depending on my guests. I've had,
had some frowners.
I've had some friends. Hey, it's noir. I've had
some That's right.
And so I am so excited to have Curtis Oppolito as my guest, who has been nominated and or won almost as many awards as Delia Pitts, and who was a former guest on the show, along with Reed Farrell Coleman, who's been nominated and won many awards. That's, we didn't plan it out that way, but I mean, later on in the show, I'm going to try to connect up you guys, because there is kind of a different kind of noir theme with you guys, especially in Reed's later works, but definitely with Delia's current works, and she has this an amazing run of novels. I just wanted to say, I love your name.
Well, it's
so cool. It's like Curtis Oppolito. I mean, you could be like a Formula One driver or a white blues guitarist.
Okay.
Welcome to the stage, Curtis Oppolito. Give it up. I mean, that is such a cool name. I mean, what is it, Italian or Greek or what?
It is Italian, yeah. Okay. And that's fun to hear said, because kind of growing up, it was always like an albatross around my siblings and my neck. We were just like, why do we get this name?
It's great. Like I said, it's
very
so
identifiable,
cool.
That's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, it is just when I like to hang on stuff like that, because it differentiates people, and it's so cool to have that kind of a name. You know, people, you know, my name is kind of boring. It sounds like it's made up, you know, especially when I'm on shows or I'm talking to somebody like Chris Chambers. It's like, really? That's his real name? But I just wanted to say, you know, with Waves of Burden, you got a really good blurb from one of my first guests and one of my longtime friends, Gary Phillips.
Gary's so great. Such a cool dude.
He is. Even before, I don't have my copy, but even before I knew about that, from like NetGalley and stuff like that. But when he puts a stamp on somebody, that's like, you know, automatically I know. I mean, Gary never fails. And what's interesting is it doesn't have to be within his and mine particular subgenre or silo. I mean, he shoots out all over the place. And, you know, when I heard, you know, when I saw, earlier when he had blurbed you, and I knew, and we're going to get to this later, I knew that, you know, Dennis Lehane was one of your kind of inspirations. That's the kind of stuff I was like, okay, when I was thinking about what kind of a topic we could dance around or theme, I said, okay, now I know what I'm going to do. but I mean, it's you know, there was it's a follow-up to just an incredible debut, Burying the Newspaper Man, which for those listeners and viewers, it has nothing to do with journalism per se. No reporters are getting murdered here. Okay.
Right.
We're just going to have to clarify that. And, you know, also, if you could tell us really just quickly, the short story analogy, I mean, was a, you know, on fire and underwater, it was a platform for so many great writers. And I mean, I think the anthology and stories in it are up for a number of awards. Tell us about the anthology for a minute.
Sure. So On Fire and Underwater is a crime fiction climate change anthology that Rock and a Hard Place put together last year, and they brought me in to guest edit, and I was very appreciative of that. And what we set out to do was to gather as diverse collection of stories, both from authors and diversity in authors, but also diversity in place, to really show the dangerous consequences climate change is having specifically on everyday people. And I think we did a really good job. You know, we have stories, most are set here in the United States because we have a lot of United States writers, but we have one in Africa, one in Norway, one in the Caribbean. And it's just this fantastic collection of stories. And all these authors did such a great job of not like making it browbeating or getting up on a pulpit, but just showing through a person's everyday life how climate change is pressuring them and impacting them even more so. And we're talking about people that are living in the margins, you know, and are living paycheck to paycheck. And then you throw climate change into the mix. And what does that do to people like that? And we're just so proud. Yeah. Megan Lucas's story got selected for Best American Mystery and Suspense.
Right.
Richie Navarez has a story. It's got an Anthony nomination. So and then it won the collection as a whole, won the Derringer Award along with Hollywood Kills. And it's also nominated for an Anthony Award. Anthony. So it's very gratifying that people are resonating with this, because it's not like a happy-go-lucky collection of stories, or these aren't fun stories. These are, you know, pretty serious. And, you know, the tone is not, you know, a lot of them not hopeful. We do have some hopeful stories, but, you know, it's, you want to talk about noir, it's noir.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because, you know, you could have just as easily put together a collection of essays on a topic, but you chose this vehicle. And, you know, as crime fiction writers, I mean, we have to kind of, we're disguised essayists almost, you know, you know, in this murder or this heist, you know, the subtext is the social commentary.
Right.
You know, when I heard about the anthology, I said, okay, now, you know, this is really probably going to make a lot of people's heads turn, because it, by its nature, it can't beat anybody over the head, because it's not that genre, you know.
Right. And,
the stories are just amazing. I mean, where did you, obviously, I mean, you're the editor, but I mean, did you kind of, were you sitting around one day in your living room and just cooked this up, or how did this come about?
So it came about a couple of editors at Rockin' a Hard Place had the idea, and one of them messaged me and said, hey, would you be interested in, you know, being the editor for this? And I honestly had to think about it, because, you know, Rockin' a Hard Place has been doing these one-off special anthologies. And, you know, the only other guest editor they had for one was Sean Cosby. And I was like, how am I going to follow Sean Cosby, you know?
Right.
But I gave it a couple days and I thought about it and I said, you know, there is no better person right now to tackle this than me. You know, I'm very passionate about climate change, very passionate about, you know, everyday people and the plight that we're in. And so I said yes, and we took off running.
Yeah, I mean, and look, you don't have to tell me. I'm here in Washington. I'm about a quarter mile from the reflecting pool, such that it is.
I'm so reflective these days, isn't it?
Yes, it is. You know, and then the weird lies about people tearing up 100 feet of this thing, unless they got scuba gear, I guess. And I mean, it literally, I was there. It literally is peeling off, and the algae blooms. You know, because it was originally built as a place to come and reflect and see the monument and everything in there. So two meanings of the word. It wasn't meant to be messed with and turned into a Roman emperor's swimming pool.
Right.
And then so you got these single source or you know, sole source contracts to paint it. And then it was gross. I mean, it was green. And you have the National Guard there walking around. I feel sorry for these poor kids, because they are from, you know, you want to get a stereotypically flyover state as much as you want. And then they put them in uniforms and put them out here first in the cold weather, now in the DC heat, to prevent people from taking pictures of the green slime. I mean, I would be so upset and just want to go home. But yeah. But that's kind of a, you know, tiny allegory. But I mean, you know, God bless you for putting that together. And again, I mean, I think it shows just how versatile, you know, we are as crime fiction writers, because we have to be.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Let me switch gears. And I usually do a humorous icebreaker. I guess the thing on your name, that'll suffice for
yeah,
now.
Sure.
But just to get a little serious, I mean, you and I are both on the board of BoucherCon World mm-hmm. Mystery Conference. It'll be in Calgary in October and here in D.C. Hopefully it'll be clean by 2027. And, you know, we're both tasked with, or you were tasked, and I said I'd help, on dealing with AI. And I was wondering your feelings about that, because I had a friend who's an extreme techie, who's from California, and she's like, I don't know what you guys are so, you know, geeked up about. And she was saying, well, what happens if you have a writer who's trying to write a scene, got writer's block, and goes on, you know, uses whatever AI tool and says, you know, I need to learn about some guy who's a gun nut. So what's the problem with this person, you know, either speaking or typing out, you know, lay out a scenario for me of what kind of a home arsenal the average lunatic would have. As long as this person isn't taking that word for word and plugging it into the manuscript. I mean, she was telling me, you know, why are you guys so afraid of that? I mean, don't you guys look stuff up on Google all the time? I mean, what do you say to that? I mean, is that facile? You know, is she kind of sniping
around the edges? So to that specific scenario, I would say by, you know, handing off a part of the creative process, in this case, brainstorming a plot point or an idea, you are giving that away as an artist.
Right.
And, you know, my example that pops to mind is, you know, when Stephen King was writing The Stand, he was stuck. He was absolutely stuck, did not know where to go. He was like, I think a middle of the way through it. And what if he had used AI to break through that, when in reality what happened is he took a long walk and an idea clicked, and it turned that book, like it just flipped a switch in that book, and we would have never gotten that idea, that great spark from him. We would have got it from a machine. Who cares?
Right. Right.
Who cares?
A machine that was ripping off other people. Yeah.
That's right. And then that's my stance of AI as a whole is, you know, at its very base, when we're talking about generative AI,
right,
it's a thievery machine. It takes everything from everyone else and produces this, you know, Frankenstein in the output. And, you know, I was talking to someone the other day, and I said, you know, if in college, in any one of my creative writing courses, I would have done what AI is doing now. I would have been expelled. It's plagiarism.
Yeah. Plain and simple. Yeah.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is that I don't want to put you on the spot, but do you think that, how can I put this? Non-creative people or non-creatives, whatever that means.
Yeah.
Can't wrap their head around what the creative process is. Like, for example, mm-hmm. this friend of mine purely couches this in terms of research. Like, she basically said, when we were little, we would have used a World Book Encyclopedia. And I'm like, no. There's, you know, looking something up.
It's totally to enrich still your brain. Using your brain, right?
Still using your brain. You're not asking it to create for you.
Right.
Yeah. But do you think that non-creative people, it's just, there's something about them that they just can't really see through that? Maybe they're the ones who need to kind of open up their minds a little bit.
I do think there's a disconnect. And I think if you have more of a scientific brain or a techie brain, like, you just see it as a new advance in technology. Right. And you can't see the human or the artistic aspect of it as easily. And I've seen this firsthand from some techie people, scientific people that I've worked with in the past. And I think it just takes us creatives reminding those people of, you know, what we do.
Right.
And, you know, I think AI has a lot of great potential uses, but it shouldn't be in the arts. You know, it should be in the, you know, I worked at a scientific institution a little while ago, and one of the things they were going to use it for is, for 30 years they've been collecting all this data about the human genome, but it is like if a human went through this data and, you know, organized it, it would take them
10,000
like 100 lifetimes. But AI could do it like then we're that closer to making medical advances. That's how it should be used.
Right.
It shouldn't be used in trying to take our jobs as artists.
Well, that's going to be my next point. I mean, because one of the other points at which she was bugging me about, you know, over a drink was, what if you, you know, whatever publishing firm you want to pick, big or small, indie or major, have a contract with that company, and then that company says, you know what, we're going to lay off our entire graphic arts department, and all of our covers now are going to be AI covers. I mean, you know, do you step up and say, well, bye-bye, or do you
have to take a stand. I think if we want graphic designers and photographers and editors to go to bat for us as writers, we need to do the same for them.
Right.
We're all creatives. And we all need, it's kind of an unorganized union, right? Like, we're unionizing under this umbrella of pushing back against that. And yeah, absolutely. If, you know, a publisher I was with said, hey, we're going to use AI for your cover, I would be like, well, let me add this contract.
A lot of people are, you know, that is something that's some real world shit right there. We can curse on this podcast, by the way.
Fuck yeah,
within reason. Good, thank you. But I mean, but that's some real world shit, because I think some people are going to be hit with that very, very soon.
And I think the more that we take a stand early, I think the more that we'll show right now in this moment, we're seeing that pushback works, right?
Oh yeah.
You know, towns are pushing back against data centers and they're backing down. You know, people are pushing back against, look at all the commencement speeches this summer in college.
Colleges. That was good to see. That was fun.
And the students are shouting them down. Like, we're at this moment. We just need to continue to take a stand and push.
Good. Okay, we got that on the record now. So let me get to the nitty gritty. Let me get to the books then. You know, when you think of ordinary people, kind of every man, if you want to use that term, it seems to be hard. It was maybe at one time, but it seems to be this weird fit where you got to, when you we have noir and kind of hard boiled sitting out here, but you have kind of an everyman, kind of a regular person, kind of fitting into that, you know, where the paradigm is this, you know, everybody's morally challenged and everything is fucked up. But this person might not be as fucked up as the rest of the world. The rest of the world might be chomping down on them. I mean, is that the commonality between, you know, Marcus Kemp in the first book and Drew Jones in the second, that they're kind of like, they aren't like these morally, you know, bankrupt or morally stripped away, more probably more accurately by life types of people. They're just trying to just do their thing. And that life comes, is that the commonality right there
That
between?
is a commonality, yeah, and it's something that I like to explore is, you know, what if you take an everyday person who just, you know, works 9 to 5 and is doing their best to take care of themselves or their family, and then they're hit with this, you know, this force, this hidden or unhidden force. Like, how do they respond? Like, what does that look like? And that's definitely a shared theme between my two books for sure.
Well, in the first one, you don't go down the rabbit hole trope because the guy's a cop of him, like, you know, seeing his partner, like, you know, murder a black or Hispanic kid or something like that. That's a lot more involved, obviously. But I mean, so it the real world grip on him is a whole lot different than what I guess some people might have. When they saw he was a cop, thought was coming down the pike. I mean, was that was deliberate? I assume. I mean, of course, it's deliberate. It's your universe, but I mean, you definitely stayed away from the usual cop moral issues, and then hit with this other thing. If you want to, you know, the book's been out a while. You can spoil it if you want, but elaborate on that a little bit, and then we'll go into in back into Drew Jones.
Sure. So yeah, Marcus Kemp is a beat cop in San Diego. And he just for anyone who doesn't know, the book is about he finds a dead body in a trunk of a stolen car, and it turns out to be the man who abused him when he was a child. So unlike a lot of murder mysteries of this sort, he sets out to find the killer to help them get away with murder, to kind of find closure to that trauma, as opposed to finding the killer to bring them to justice. And so it was a very deliberate thing that I did in that case. You know, I tried to even stay away from cop tropes. Like, I didn't want him to have like a drinking problem and like, you know, an ex-wife and, you know, all these things you see in detective fiction, you know, because that wasn't what the story was about. It, you know, him finding this killer is, yeah, technically the A story, but the B story under it is all about him trying to bury this childhood trauma. And thinking that this is gonna fix it by finding this killer and letting him off. And so all those choices I made to steer away from tropes or from you know any you know thing cliches or things that you would see in normal detective fiction, those are all very deliberate, you know.
Well, so jump into Drew Jones. I mean, that's more of the everyman, you know, because you know, yes, Marcus Kemp is kind of an everyman, but the uniform definitely, you know, takes it in another direction. But he's more of an everyman. So what, you know, and this is coming out. So we'll be careful not to give away too much. But what's Drew's main problem?
So Drew is a he is a father to be, but reluctantly so. And that reluctance is really rooted in his childhood trauma. And he doesn't know if he can be a good father. He doesn't know if he can provide for a child or if he's even ready to. And this was just kind of thrown on him. So the book, for everyone who doesn't know, is about Drew. And he has an adult foster brother that comes in and out of his life, and he comes back into town. And he gets Drew involved in a convenience store, a liquor store robbery gone wrong, and goes on the run. And so Drew has to go track him down and bring back the $100,000 that he stole, or this criminal that's after them will kill them both. And so it's really a story about how far do these bonds of brotherhood go, and how, you know, how much does Drew stay loyal to someone who isn't technically his blood, but he sees his blood, over the new family that he's starting and his commitment and you know, love for them.
There, the interesting pivot, and correct me if I'm wrong, because you know I'm a lot older than you, so you know, my brain's not working as well as possible all the time, and it must be all that bourbon too. But there's you have this character Gabby,
mm-hmm.
And she's kind of a moral center. You don't necessarily have that in the first book. Do you?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, yeah. Gabby,
I mean, was that deliberate? Again, it's your universe. Yes, it's deliberate. But I mean, yeah. Were you really trying to pivot and put somebody in that role that you didn't have?
I wasn't necessarily comparing it to Burying the Newspaper Man. It just felt right for this story. Gabby is Drew's wife,
right?
And, you know, they're a fairly new married couple. But I really did see her as the moral compass of this story. And I just had a launch event yesterday and told everyone, I was like, you know, if Drew did everything that his wife told him to do, he listened to her, there wouldn't be a book. So, but Gabby's
most
right.
Most wives will say that anyway, right?
But Gabby's right about everything, you know?
Right. So. Well, then my next question is going to be, fitting it into your universe and in Burying the Newspaper Man, why didn't you have somebody sitting out there that could be an alternate gravitational pull to Marcus? I mean, what was the thought there? I mean, you know, I'm not asking you to rewrite the book. I'm just, is it because it's just from my point of view, it's an interesting juxtaposition because you got, yeah, the guy's married. He's got, you know, he's trying to start his new life in the new book, but you've got the, you know, you've got your debut where, you know, you probably could have done that there. What's your thought process?
My thought process with that was, I saw Marcus more as a lone wolf and, you know, and not by like this alpha, you know,
no, I understand.
That we see, but more so as just like, he's just going along his life and, you know, he hasn't started a family yet. He has an on again, off again girlfriend, but you know, he's a cop, so he has a position of authority. So I really saw that, you know, someone like that would try to take matters into their own hand. And, you know, he has some people like some friends and a supervisor who, you know, kind of try to gently nudge him, you know, in the right direction.
Right.
I saw him more as as the lone wolf and just trying to tackle these problems on his own.
No, that's, you know, look good. Keep those answers coming because that's why you're such a great writer. I mean, you took one form and then boom, you pivoted to another one and you can pivot to another one and another one. I mean, that's what separates the, you know, the Curtises from everyone else. But let me ask you this. I mean, this is kind of a business question. You know, a lot of people try to silo us at times, and sometimes I get on a high horse and I blame agents and publishers because they want to use this kind of thriller label all the time, mm-hmm. because thriller is new school. Right. And mystery and crime fiction is too academic and mystery is too old school. And, you know, because that way you can just, you know, automatically printing press, high octane thriller, boom, high octane thriller, boom, twist, 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 boom, twist, yeah. twist, twist, you know, red herring, red herring, red herring. I mean, do you think that's out there? I mean, that there's pressure to either label something that's, you know, that I feel are just amazing slow burn character studies, but for marketing purposes, high octane thriller. I mean, do you think that's a thing, or am I just talking out of my ass?
I think it's somewhat of a thing, but I think maybe authors make a little more of a thing about it I don't know if readers are sitting around really dissecting that.
Right, right.
But it certainly affects how a book reaches a reader or readers, right? So
yeah.
That's why we're, as authors, we're so concerned about it. Yeah.
Yeah, because I what I've noticed is, thank you for bringing up the reader part. I have it here in my notes, by the way. Good, minds think alike. That they love that, in that they get that, they seem to get that label all the time. So when they do get something that's a slow burn or something that's pretty meticulously put together, and you see where the characters are and you see where the plot points are, that they actually get pleasantly surprised by that. Right. You know, whereas they're not looking for a car chase or, you know, some wife or femme fatale double crossing somebody on every page. That's the part, at least when I see that, I really love that. But it just seems to me just pressure, maybe not in our different subgenres, but maybe in others, you know, I mean, you know, maybe in like, you know, domestic suspense or something like that, pressure to put in, you know, a twist on every page. You know, is this guy I met at the bar really my husband's cousin, and is he really going to kill me? Well, no, that's a red herring. That, you know, because they want to, you know, see that. And but thank you for putting that in perspective of the readers. That's something, you know, that's interesting, and I think that's a really good point. I mean, you're writing for yourself and the readers. You're not writing for your agent or your publisher.
Right, right.
So let me get this, put this back on something personal then. I mean, okay, here it comes. Do you see? you might have expected this coming. Is there any bit of you in either or Drew or Marcus?
Oh, okay. I'd probably say there was a little more of me in Marcus, and I think that's because it was my first book.
Your wife will probably say, no, he's Drew, but go ahead.
But no, it was, you know, a lot of authors, I think, in their first book kind of use themselves as inspiration, and maybe most times not consciously, right?
Right.
And so there were some things after I wrote that, I was like, oh, yeah, I see where I got this. And, you know, like where Marcus grew up was where I grew up. It was just easy to play off of that. Drew is, I don't think like me at all. Like, I think we're different people. And I really tried to make that so when I wrote him. I wanted him to feel real and not a part of me. You know, the only thing that's real about Drew is where he lives. And, you know, when my wife and I moved to San Diego, that's where we lived. And okay. So I set their home where we first lived when we moved to San Diego, just because I have such great fond memories of living there. But yeah, I think the further you get along, if you're not doing a series character, I think the further you get away from basing a character on yourself, at least that's kind of how I feel in my experience.
Is there anybody, your wife and Gabby? You knew that was coming.
Yeah. No, and she wants to everyone to make sure that she is not pregnant and doesn't want to get pregnant. So.
Right. And happy Father's Day, everybody.
That's right.
This on Father's Day.
But I would say, like, you know, her strength and how smart and intelligent she is. I really appreciate that about my wife. She's, you know, she is my moral compass. And I look to her quite often to, you know, for her intelligence and to steer me in the right direction.
Did she see any portion of the manuscript where you had scenes with Gabby in it?
Sharon reads everything first.
Oh, okay.
She takes great pride, and she wants to read my stuff before any of my beta readers. So, yeah.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why Gabby is the moral center.
That's right.
You know, subconsciously or consciously. Well, let me ask you, you mentioned the place, San Diego. It's not one of the biggins in terms of hard boiled or noir, whatever right. Your definition of both is. But we write about what we know, as you said. there is this notion, if you're, you know, I know people in California, especially people in LA that don't know anything about the city at all. And then you got East Coast people and Midwest people. I mean, you know, we have a notion of it as, you know, you're close to Tijuana and people might, you know, sunbathe there. You know, what is so dangerous besides the Tijuana part about this place? I mean, what is so, in terms of atmosphere? I mean, do you think about that lack of familiarity that a reader might have, or do you try to inject, you know, some of the, you know, these kind of, you know, kind of stylized realism about the place?
So there's a few thoughts I have. When I set out to write this book, Weight of Burden, I gave myself three rules. I said I wanted it to be fun, because burying the newspaper man was a little tense, and I wanted to have fun writing this. I wanted it to be fun, have a lot of heart, and make the reader, after they finish reading it, want to visit San Diego. And the reason is, I love this place. It was where I was meant to live. You know, it is wonderful. And, you know, I think what you said is true, is a lot of people just think of San Diego as beaches, as laying out. But, you know, we're the most biodiverse county in the country. That means we have the most plants, animals, insects of any county in the continental United States. And that shows in our mountains, in our backcountry, in our valleys. And it's incredibly diverse. And then the people are incredibly diverse. We have all these neighborhoods just like L.A., where, you know, we have little Koreatown, we have a wonderful Latino population, you know, Black community. Like, we have all these communities that really make San Diego so diverse. And so I love it so much. And then the thing about setting everything in San Diego for me is, I think it catches the reader off guard, because you think, oh, this is set in San Diego. It's an idyllic, you know, paradise. What could go wrong here? Right. But, you know, we're a city just like any other city. We have crime. We have murders. We have theft. You know, we have, embezzlement in our city hall. Like, we're just as corrupt as anywhere else.
Right.
You know, maybe not as much as L.A., certainly not as much as L.A. or New York. But, you know, there's crime everywhere. And I love that juxtaposition of, you know, setting a story in this place that gets sun 320 days out of the year.
That helps.
Yeah. And just catching the reader off guard.
There's in that regard, and we're going to come back to the noir and the hard-boiled aspect. But I mean, in terms of the place, I mean, there, do you ever feel pulled to the more familiar poles or institutions of the city, one being, I guess, the military, and the other being, Tijuana is right there. I mean, because there's probably a wealth of stories in either. I mean, you know, and I remember I was talking to who was it? One of the masters. It was it wasn't Dennis Lehane, not your hero, nor mine, Pelicanos. It was somebody, and it wasn't Reed Farrell-Clum. It'll come to me. He was saying that setting anything in a military town where you've got a lot of fish out of water, young people, you know, who are independent, you know, and really clueless for the first time with all these temptations, is definitely grist for a story. And anything close to the border is grist for a story too, especially, you know, with Tijuana is like iconic, legendary. Have you ever been tempted to introduce either of those institutions or kind of?
I've just dabbled a little bit. You know, I find that I write a lot of my, a few of my side characters, or this novel I'm working on now, like one of the main characters' dad is a Navy vet. Okay. So I work a lot of like background, like this person, you know, is a retired Navy vet or something of that nature. But I'm not so immersed in that community that I feel comfortable writing from that perspective. That could certainly change. And, you know, you see, signs of the military here, you know, everywhere. We're, you know, the Navy is the largest employer in San Diego.
Right.
So it makes sense, but I have not, you know, dabbled too much in that. And then same thing with the border. Like there's other authors doing that so much better than I could. But once I get, you know, immersed in that and, you know, if I find the right story idea, I would certainly write about that.
The atmosphere question now, and noir and hard boiled. Let me ask you this. Well, I mentioned Delia Pitts before, and I mentioned, you know, your hero, Dennis Lehane. There seems to be, and he was probably, you know, obviously more kind of protoplasm for that. And then you've got people like you and Delia now. The noir seems to be more atmospheric and less about, you know, again, the moral bankruptcy of even the, you know, the protagonist, less about that, but more about the, you know, situational and atmospheric at the same time. Is that, you know, rather than, you know, the mean truths of life kind of thing? I mean, is that a thing that a trend that we should, you know, definitely be looking at? Because I, like I said, you guys tend to pull, even though these people are in like the bear claws of real, you know, real moral issues and just, you know, fucking in trouble, you know, they're not like that all the time. You know, I mean, there might be one little character flaw that pulls them that's based on trauma or something like that. But there isn't like this hopelessness and the world is fucked kind of a trope that you see in other parts of noir. You know, and again, with Delia Pitts, with like Death of an Ex and Murder and some trouble in Queenstown. I mean, there seems to be this thing where there is this atmospheric and structural noir and hardboiled stuff going on, but there's hope. And these characters are not, you know, just total, you know, just bum. Everybody's a bum and you can't, you know, can't tell the difference between, you know, the who's going to turn out okay and who's not. Is that a function of you all's personality? Or maybe, the backgrounds, yeah. You know, in terms of writing and who your inspiration is. But go ahead.
Yeah, it may be. You know, I had I have a really good friend who had told me after he read a short story of mine, is like, he said that he recognizes that my characters are really reluctant to turn to violence. And he's like, it's so easy to write violence. So I admire that about your writing. And I said, you know, it's probably a product of I'm, you know, reluctant to use violence. I don't want it to be a violent person. And so to your greater question, I think that's probably the case is, you know, we writers are writing what we know and what we see every day. And I tend to write with more of a realism, whether that's, you know, realistically showing San Diego or showing a realistic side of a person just going through life every day. And then they're caught up in this extraordinary event that, you know, we're always told, you know, the best fiction is, you know, write about a person's worst day, you know, the worst time in their life. And so that can meet anyone. All you have to do is kind of look around at the state of the country, the state of the world, and we're living through a noir right now, right?
Right, right. Yeah, we are.
We don't have to be these horrible people that are, you know, one punch from the gutter. You know, we can just be ourselves and be trying to survive this noir world that we're living through right now.
So, yeah, so that is kind of almost the everyman kind of situation, you know, and every man in this noir world, but not everybody navigates that. I mean, there are people who, you know, not for any moral failings, you just don't get up over that wall. Mm-hmm. I think it seems to me with you and, you know, and again, people like Delia and other writers, luckily its protagonist does get over that wall. But in real life, the person you're rooting for might not even come close, might get kicked back down. I mean,
yeah.
Do you see yourself writing either short fiction or a novel length something where the person doesn't quite get to the wall? I mean, is it, you know, does there, and again, I'm not talking about happy endings, okay? But is there that kind of a story in you, or do you want to keep, you know, your present kind of direction?
I don't know. It would just depend on the right idea coming along. And, you know, I think I've been thinking about this with the novel I'm working on now. It's a, you know, a murder mystery, and, you know, there it's a multi point of view, and I don't think things are going to work out for a couple of the characters. So we'll see. But the story's informing that to me,
right,
more so than my intention going into it.
So you basically said you're a pantser now. Is that what?
A little bit, yeah. Like I'm kind of I think I'm in the middle ground. Like I've outlined the last two novels that I've written, but I certainly leave room to make changes as I go along.
Yeah, there's Tracy Clark is like the super pantser.
Yeah,
and. She was in D.C. recently, and Delia Pitts, speaking of Delia and some others, and Cheryl Head. I mean, Cheryl's kind of a hybrid like you, but Delia's very meticulous. And they were just aghast at our, you know, yeah. It's like, yeah.
I've heard Tracy talk about her process, and I'm more power to you.
She's scared. Yeah, look, she scares me. I mean, it literally, I was thinking about if she and I were in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the scene that would inspire us the most would be Richard Dreyfuss tearing up his house and throwing all that crap into his basement, including mud and trees and grass, to build, you know, the Devil's Tower, you know, where any normal person would have just basically, like, found some, you know, back then they didn't have the internet, but lots of magazines, or gone to the library and said, oh, okay, this looks a lot like what I've been imagining. But it's you know, it's scary, to be a pantser, I think, probably scarier. I mean, this is my opinion, but, do you find that, the outlining part, dominates, or does the pantsing part dominate? I mean, because you can change an outline. I mean, you don't have to be locked in. It doesn't have to be like Jeffrey Deaver where, you know, there's a 100-page outline and it's a railroad track. I mean, do you fall off on either side? I mean, how does that work in your process?
No, I kind of use, you know, I like the outline because it gives me the roadmap, and it, you know, shows me the beats that I need to hit and the structure that I need to follow. And those are really important for me because, you know, readers have expectations, you know, but at the same time, humans are natural storytellers, right? So we have this ingrained in us, you know, we have the hero's journey in the back of our head, right, from our primitive DNA, right? So anytime that I'm going along and something doesn't feel right because of something I've previously written, or I've thought of a new, you know, twist or the ending, like, it's all malleable. So I try not to stress either way about it. Because like you said, an outline can be changed, and, you know, if you're pantsing, those ideas can be changed too. So,
well, it goes back to what, you know, I'd said before about these silos and labels of thrillers. And, you know, I tease like super outliners all the time about, you know, is this where you put in the red herring?
Yeah,
right. You know? Yeah. And some of them say yes, it is what it is.
Yeah.
Let me jump, before we finish up, is your process, any different for your short fiction, or, did you have a whole new head or how does that work?
So probably in the last couple of years, I did turn to a semi outlined approach to writing short stories. I found this really neat five-beat trick on Twitter one day. And I've
not
been
AI Twitter.
Yeah, pre-AI Twitter. Pre-AI. Yes. And so I've been following that, and it's really great for maintaining a nice structure. And again, like even in short stories, you got to hit some of these beats to make the story come together. So, you know, it's very loose. I just take the five tips and I write like a line or two. And as I'm writing, be like, oh, yep. I'm into the climax scene and I need these things to happen before we come to the ending. And so that really helps. Yeah.
Yeah. Stacey Woodson and Michael Bracken will be proud of that statement. But is it kind of just a miniaturized world for you, or is it a totally different?
It's totally different. Yeah. Like, you know, a short story, I may be able to rip one off in a couple days, and then some take weeks or a month. It just depends on the story. But it really is so much different because you know, in a short story, you know, every word counts. You've got to be precise. You've got to be clear. But also, you know, we're writing crime and mystery, so you've got to have some, you know, mystery there, some suspense.
Right.
And I really find with short stories, like pacing is even more important than in novels, because, you know, novel, you have 80,000, 90,000 words to meander. And
right.
As long as you like speed up and slow down in the right spots, you're going to be okay. But in a short story, you have to set that pace from the beginning and then maintain it to the end, no matter what the pace is. And some that can be difficult in only a 3,000 to 5,000 word space.
Yes. I mean, I, you know, when I do it, it's like, wow, I can't believe I actually did this. I mean, it's like a miracle. And I see it in other people, and I'm just amazed. I was at ShortCon, which is based here in the DMV. I was at, they graciously allowed me to welcome people. And, you know, and I said, you know, you guys are like the master technicians of this craft, because this is very specialized and very tough. But in terms of novels, I mean, can you give us a thumbnail preview of what you're working on now?
Sure. So it's a murder mystery set in, you guessed it, San Diego.
Yeah.
And it's my first time doing a multi point of view. One's a mother, one is a grieving widower, and one is a homicide detective. And I'm pitching it as a cross between Small Mercies by Dennis Lehane and Mayor of Easttown.
Oh, wow. Okay. Cool. Cool. Yeah. But with the latter, you know, there's a lot of crossover tendrils between that and what Delia's doing, you know, too. I mean, and that is so cool and so forward in terms of the evolution of noir and hard boiled stuff. That it's good to hear that. Although I would like to see you do some morally corrupt protagonist.
Okay, I'll get on that.
Please do. I mean, you know, they don't have to have a cocaine habit or anything like that. I mean, you know, there's plenty of other bad things people can get into. So, you know, Curtis, this has been a real pleasure. Waves of Burden coming out this week. Grab it. There it is. Grab it before, you know, when you go out on your beach vacation, you know.
Perfect. But remember,
that's right. And remember, but it's deep, though. It's fun, but it's deep. Okay. And go back and buy Burying the Newspaper Man if you really just want to go deep and crazy. You know, it's a great, that is a great book. I would tell you, people, I recommend reading that first and then look what Curtis comes up with next. Dude, that'll blow your mind, rather than, you know, buy this book, but read Burying the Newspaper Man first, then go see what he's doing with Waves of Burden. And I also want to just say that this is the 25th anniversary of my first hardcover, not the publication date, but when I got my first blurb ever as a writer, and it was from Michael Deaver. I'm sorry, Jeffrey Deaver, not Michael Deaver. What am I thinking? I'm dating myself. That's the Reagan guy, Jeffrey Deaver. And I saw Jeff here in the DMV, and he said he remembered the book, and he was so just
that's supportive, so cool.
And I almost started crying. And there were witnesses. I have witnesses. I asked Barry.
That's a great thing about this crime fiction community, though, right? We're all so supportive of each other and, you know, take up for each other. And, you know, we see this at the conferences we go to.
That, oh, yeah. It's beautiful.
And we just all get along, and it's a great community.
Well, I'll end on this note then. It's a really quick story. Curtis has never heard this story. Everybody else I've bored them with. I was at an Edgar's, and a certain very famous literary writer was nominated for this Edgar. And, you know, certain famous people in our circles had been pleading with this famous author to blurb him or support him in any way. And this person kind of like, nah, nah, nah. And then all of a sudden they're both nominated for the same category. So this person comes in, a Pulitzer Prize winner, who I've actually known since he was a little boy. And was at the cocktail party before the awards dinner, and he was marveling at how nice everybody was and how wonderful everybody was. And this other writer, who we all know, kind of rubbed his chin and said, you know, we crime fiction writers are wonderful people who write about horrible things. You literary fiction people are horrible people who write about wonderful things. So I'll just leave it at that. You can guess all the names. I'm sure you can do that easily. But thank you, Curtis.
Thank you, Curtis
Bolito. Get Waves of Burden out in a couple of days. This is Chris Chambers Noir. You can listen to us on Spotify, iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, the Incandescent Radio Network, and I did say Spotify, didn't I? And you can watch us on YouTube. Thank you so much.
Thank you all. Thank you. And that AI conversation was amazing. It scares me to death. For creatives, yeah, for scientists and all that other stuff, where they stand on each other's shoulders, but not for us, right? So yeah, it'll right. Hopefully it'll come out in the wash, or we'll just, you know, be the reflecting pool and have algae. All right. Thank you all. We'll talk to you all next month on Chris Chambers Noir. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, proud producer of the show on all the channels that Chris mentioned. We will talk to you very soon.